Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Good morning, Jim and Austin. Austin, you wrote recently about the October War in 1967 in Israel. 1973, excuse me, getting the 67 and the 73 war mixed up. So the Yom Kippur War, as it's referred to sometimes. What made that war significant as compared to maybe the 67 and the 56 war? How did that set up what we're experiencing today in the Middle East?
Well, quick background on this. This is the 40th anniversary of the October War of 1973. The Israelis call it the Yom Kippur War now. You'll see some of the Arabs refer to it as the Ramadan War. And it's also called the Arab-Israeli War of 1973. You'll find all various histories have used those terms, sometimes interchangeably. Dan, the reason that the 1973 October War is more relevant to Israel's current geopolitical situation is because it was a bare win. The Israelis won. I could argue that at a tactical and operational level, it was by the end of the war, the end of the month, the October 25th, 26th, 27th of 1973, the Israelis had won a significant victory. But the first 72 to 96 hours of the war, which began with a simultaneous attack by the Syrians on the Golan Heights and the Egyptians across the Suez Canal on October 6th, 1973, that first 3 to 4 days was Israel almost lost. And the Israelis, as I say in the column, very complicated internal political situation, very complicated intelligence situation the Israelis faced in the days prior to October 6th. But historians generally say that there were two mistakes that the Israelis made. Now, I'll start with what was the success on the part of the Egyptians and the Syrians. The Egyptians and the Syrians ran a successful political and military deception campaign to camouflage their preparations for an offensive attack in early October 1973. But the Israelis, 1967, Dan, it had been such an overwhelming victory that Israeli confidence was extraordinarily high, and the government had also made a decision because of the criticism that they got with the preemptive attack in 1967. Understand, in 1967, the Israelis launched an air attack and an armor attack, specifically the big punch in the Sinai, because the Egyptians had put several hundred tanks into Sinai and into the Gaza Strip area, and it was clear that Nasser's forces were going to launch an attack. The Israelis struck preemptively, and of course they took a great deal of criticism for doing the right thing. In that case, they're about to be attacked. They have a very narrow nation. They didn't have any depth. So, but in 1973, the Israelis government said, well, we have more strategic depth. They got this entire Sinai Peninsula and a Suez Canal, and we control the key terrain features in the Golan Heights, and that gives us more depth. They deferred a decision. I need to back up to the intelligence was not certain about Egypt's and Syria's intent to attack. So there was an intelligence failure, in part the failure due to the deception success on the part of Syria and Egypt. But the government, when it became clear that there was a significant buildup in the Golan Heights and a significant amount of military activity across the Suez Canal in Egypt, the government considered the situation and decided, no, we're not going to attack preemptively. At the last minute, they did decide to call up the reserves, and as Jim has pointed out on numerous occasions, the Israeli military, the Israeli Defense Forces, are really, their strengths are in their reserves. They've kind of got a small active component that is a covering force and the Air Force, but then they mobilize several hundred thousand reservists within 36 to 48 hours. So, but the government deferred the mobilization until really the last moment before the Egyptians and Syrians attack. So, to relate that to 2013, the Israelis see those as grievous errors, their intelligence failure, and their decision to not attack preemptively. And they see Iran's quest for a nuclear weapon. Iran has the Ahmadinejad, but he's not the only member of the I know Ahmadinejad is no longer a major figure in Iranian politics, but he is one of several Iranian leaders that has used the term called Israel a one-bomb state, which they think of as a joke, but the Israelis don't take it as a joke, meaning that they can't take a nuclear attack. And they are convinced, the Israelis are convinced, that Iran will get a nuclear weapon and that they can't count on the UN, the United States, the Group of Five plus one to slow down or eliminate the Iranian nuclear weapons program. And they think back to 1973. Interestingly enough, I wrote that column before Prime Minister Netanyahu gave a speech this past Tuesday, which would have been what, the 15th, the evening of the 15th, on the anniversary commemoration day of the 1973 October War, and he mentioned the failure to act aggressively and with anticipation, to anticipate the attack as a huge mistake. And subsequently, yesterday on the 16th, I read a couple of other commentaries discussing Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech, where they made the immediate connection to the Iranian situation. I've been thinking about writing, Dan, about the October War for 2 or 3 weeks because it, in from a military perspective, and I'll add this commentary because I know a lot of our audience is interested in the military historical aspects. One of the things that it was very impressive to me about the October War was the Egyptian offensive plan, which was shaped in part by the president at the time, Anwar Sadat, who was of course a general. The plan was tied very clearly to political objectives, because Sadat looked at the low morale in his own country after the 1967 war, and a loss, a shame, that may be a harsh word, but that was embarrassment throughout the Arab world because of the 1967 loss. And he thought that if you could attack into Sinai and have a significant or a victory over the Israelis, particularly the Israeli armored forces, Israeli tank forces. It would be a morale boost, a political morale boost within Egypt. And there's some thinking that Sadat was already trying to figure out how he might move to a rapprochement with Israel, as you see in the Camp David process from the Carter administration. It would take success, he felt, on the part of Egypt in order to build a political will or political opportunity to make a deal with Israel. He's going to fight a war so he can make peace. Anyway, that's one line of analysis on it. But the plan certainly reflects that political goal. The Egyptians would cross the canal. They would operate within a surface air missile and anti-aircraft artillery umbrella to drive off the Israeli Air Force. And they hoped that there would be, as I described it in the column, a hell for leather armor counterattack, primarily by tanks. And so they trained some of their assault infantry forces to dig in, wait for the tanks to approach, hide in foxholes or the like, with RPGs and Sager anti-tank missiles, which was a man packed a suitcase and ATGMs of the time, and ambush the tanks. And to a degree, it worked. I mean, they had a tactical component that reinforced the operational plan, but also worked into what Sadat had as a political objective. So that most of the column actually is addresses the historical aspects of the war and relating them to 2013. But I did put in a paragraph about that Egyptian that Egyptian plan. One other thing too, I'll add, because I know Jim is a very knowledgeable about the October War, is the Syrian front in some ways was the most grave. The Syrians managed to put some 1,100 or 1,200 tanks up close to the border. They had to attack, though, on very narrow axes, and the two Israeli brigades, but especially the tank components. The Israelis had between about 125 and 150 tanks in those brigades, put up one of the most hellacious armored defenses anyone in history has ever fought. They you had Israeli 10 Israeli tanks taking on 100 Syrian tanks in narrow valleys, and it was a huge shootout with really gutsy Syrian tankers and amazingly courageous Israeli tankers. The Syrians almost broke through. The Israelis held, and then the reserves arrived. So that's the relationship, but also a little bit of the history of the October War.
Jim, what would you like to fill in there?
One of the big things that the 73 War did was, as Austin pointed out, it gave the Arabs better morale. In other words, because they didn't lose as heavily as they had in 67, by Arab standards, this is the way they measure things, it was a victory. Of course, it wasn't. They lost on every front, but they didn't lose as big as they lost in 1967. The other thing that the Arabs won, which they didn't make as much noise about, was it really wasn't a preemptive, the Israelis really wouldn't be conducting a preemptive strike if they attacked when the military wanted to. The military had figured out 2 days before the Egyptian attack that the Egyptians were definitely up to no good. So that had conducted a very clever deception campaign basically by holding a lot of training exercises on the canal, in the Israeli defenses were very thin, basically just monitoring. And what Sadat did was he kept holding these exercises where he sent the troops up, got the bridging equipment and whatnot, did everything short of actually starting to cross the canal. And that was a very clever thing because either he would constantly force the Israelis to start mobilizing, which cost them a lot of money, or the Israelis would get in the habit of not mobilizing. So all Sadat had to do was, at one point, was to go. Now, it was later found out that the Israelis had been watching this rather more closely than was first believed after the war. And they were pressuring Golda Meir, the head of Israel, to make a preemptive attack. And as Austin pointed out, she declined to, as she said constantly after the war, because she didn't want to be accused of attacking the Arabs preemptively. The problem with that is, and she was falling for, you know, the Arab propaganda as well, was that the Arabs had already declared war on Israel by closing the Suez Canal to them, the canal, and basically trying to blockade Eilat, you know, in the Red Sea. That is generally acknowledged as an act of war, and Israel did not respond. So there began the attitude in the West and in the world, actually, of holding Israel and the Arabs to a different standard in regards to what is war and what is aggression, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, for Israel, it's been all downhill since then. Even though the Egyptians made peace in 1979, and, of course, Sadat got assassinated a year later for his efforts, the Arabs basically established the principle that we are the underdogs, and you know, you have to look the other way when we do nasty things. And they basically exploited that big time ever since.
So, Austin, that sets up for where we're at today. What sort of connections do you see, and how is it shaping our political landscape and what's going on in perhaps Syria and the connections with Iraq and Iran?
Well, I've touched on the Iranian situation. The overwhelming concern with the Israelis, of course, is a nuclear-armed Iran that would use a nuclear weapon on Israel, either sneak it in with the Hezbollah or shoot it, or use it to intimidate nations in the region into taking a harder line against the Israelis. I mean, there are a lot of scenarios that are obtained once if the Iranians obtain a nuclear weapon. Political scenarios out there and war making scenarios. I've addressed that in terms of why the Israelis would launch a preemptive strike on Iran's nuclear weapons program. The situation with Syria, in my view, coming out of the 73 October war, is more opaque, and I'm not sure that the Assad regime from 67 on used the loss of the Golan as a political tool within Syria to say, yeah, we're bad, but look, the Israelis have taken part of our country. Since the Arab Spring uprising and the Syrian civil war, which we've talked about several times over the last 2.5 years, it's clear that many Syrians no longer buy it. They don't see the Israelis as the threat. They see the Assad regime as the Syrian rebels. See the Assad regime as a bigger enemy than the Israelis, which is in my view, a correct interpretation on their part. That said, at least four times in the last 2 years, the Assad regime has tried to use the Golan Heights issue as a political galvanizing ploy. Didn't work. I'm not saying that, you know, what that it couldn't work for them in the future, but it failed. Now, the other component I see is, of course, Hezbollah land in southern Lebanon, and Lebanese Hezbollah is, as we've said on the page several times, is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Iranians. Maybe a little bit extreme, but they are supplied and really run by the Iranian Al-Quds intelligence and special forces component. The Israelis see that as a constant problem, and it's very conceivable that if they did launch a preemptive strike on Iran, that you would also see action against Hezbollah preemptive to try to stop the counterattack by Hezbollah on northern Israel with another rocket war. This direct tie to 73, no, it's ancillary, but again, the Israelis see the strategic mistake. I noticed I did say the government. Jim correctly said Golda Meir. I just left the personality out of it, but it was Mrs. Meir that deferred the decision. So she bears most responsibility for it. Moshe Dayan, Jim, I think he was defense minister at the time. I don't recall it, but certainly in the government, Moshe Dayan wanted to mobilize and launch an attack on both the Egyptians and the Syrians. That came out in the extensive investigation that Jim was referring to that the Israelis conducted after the 1973 October War.
Jim?
Yes.
Tell us about how you feel that the October War has shaped our world today.
Well, it demonstrated in strictly military terms that the Arabs were still inferior to Israel. And there have been no subsequent attacks on Israel, you know, military attacks. The October War basically was declared a victory by the Arabs, even though they knew that from that point on, it was hopeless to attack the Israelis, unless there was some fundamental change, like nuclear weapons. And even that wasn't guaranteed, because the Israelis at that point started to develop their own nuclear weapons, and now they have, in effect, mutually assured destruction. They have submarines that can fire cruise missiles equipped with nuclear weapons. They have ballistic missiles. They have a deterrent against nuclear weapons. So all the Arabs had left was terrorism, and they've unleashed that, and that was defeated. So now they've turned to their third weapon, the third wave, as it were, which is the UN and lawfare and politics, basically, trying to enlist the Europeans, which is a major pillar of the Israeli economy. The Israeli economy, by the way, is an ongoing insult to the Arabs, because Israel is the most prosperous country in the Middle East. And they're the one without any oil. And they've just recently discovered offshore gas deposits, which will make them energy independent. And even now they'll have an energy advantage, which they didn't have before. So the Arabs are basically at their wit's end. Now, as Austin pointed out, many Arabs, like the Syrians, realize that this business of Israel being the enemy is all a ploy by these dictatorships and tyrannies that have been running the Arab world since World War II to basically deflect attention from the tyrants. You say, hey, it's not our fault, because it's true. You know, you read, especially when the web came along, everybody got on the bandwagon of having multi-language websites, newspapers. So for once, people, I mean, it always used to drive me nuts in the old days. I had to get an interpreter. You know, I'd get things in Arabic and all sorts of languages, Russian and German and whatnot I could handle, but the Arabic was always beyond me, as well as the Hebrew in Israel. But now you don't need an interpreter, and you can go to their English language and you find pretty outrageous stuff by, you know, Western standards, where the Israelis are blamed for everything. I mean, a lot of it shows up in the news as humor, you know, and people have to ask, is this from The Onion or from AP? You know, for example, the Egyptians accusing the Israelis of using sharks or fish or whatever, carrying electronics, which they couldn't find, to spy on them, or the birds. You know, with carrying identification tags. Well, this is another Israel, you know, intelligence operation. But the Arabs have been able to basically sell many in the West, especially leftists, you know, who no longer had an enemy after after the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, to declare the Israelis are the new Nazis. And they are making headway on this. Anti-Semitism is on a big time increase in Europe and other parts of the world. And though everybody, governments officially decry and condemn this, except for Iran when Ahmadinejad was president, but now he's out and the Iranians learned their lesson. You know, you can basically use this outrageous propaganda up to a point. And when you go beyond that point, as Ahmadinejad did, you're basically kind of productive. So the new guy is all sweetness and light, but he's not giving up an inch. He says, let's negotiate. You give me something, I'll be nice. But that's as far as it goes. So the Arabs are using this because nothing else makes any progress for them. In effect, this is a sign of defeat, which many Arabs, as Austin pointed out in Syria, which is the most blatant example, but it's happening all over the Arab world for the last decade or so. Even the Saudis are supporting it. They call it the Arab Reform Movement. Now, it's basically a club of people who, intellectuals and what have you, Arab intellectuals and academics who give conferences to basically discuss, see how far they can, how much they can get away with. You know, with their sponsor being the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. But many senior people, including the king in Saudi Arabia, say less. We need more of what the West has. And I'm not talking about the money and consumer goodies. We're talking about their economic and political systems. And it's hard, very hard, very difficult for the Arabs to do this because they have basic cultural things. For example, not allowing a lot of restrictions on women, disdain for education, a long time disdain for translating, foreign non-Arabic books, or even publishing books in Arabic. They have a tiny, they've long had a tiny publishing thing. So, in other words, the transmission of information, even locally produced information, was much more limited in the Arab world. So when the Arabs complain about, you know, when they blame the West or somebody else, for their lack of economic, cultural, et cetera, progress. A lot of Arabs started pointing out in the last two decades that, you know, as the old cartoon goes, we have met the enemy and they are us. And this is very unpalatable for many Arabs because a lot of people, they grew up with this propaganda that is not our fault. It's the Israelis, it's the CIA, it's anybody but us. And that trope, which has been basically, you know, embedded in throughout the Arab culture, many Arabs are saying, no, that's the cause of the trouble, and we have to get away from that. And it's very difficult to, you know, to turn around. We saw that, for example, in the West, when the wall came down in Germany, and Germany was reunited in 1990, everybody thought, oh, it's all sweetness and light from here on in, but it wasn't. Because what they found out was that the Stasi, the secret police in East Germany, was much worse than anybody expected. They also found out KGB in Russia, when Russia came out, was much more effective than anybody thought. That was a big shock then with the CIA, let me tell you, and the FBI, et cetera. But the East Germans, or the Germans in general, discovered that the people who had grown up, the baby boomer generation, so to speak, and had undergone decades of living in this communist police state and this all this socialism and what have you, extreme socialism, did not quickly change. In other words, they were stuck. They were in shock. And they found out that the teenagers, the people who were teenagers when the wall came down, they, you know, teenagers are always open to new stuff, which drives parents nuts. But in a way, it's good. Because in this case, it allowed all these rebellious teenagers to learn about capitalism, market economy, you know, political freedoms, etc. And that generation, as it gets older and gets, you know, in charge, as it were, that's when, after decades, that Germany will finally be united. And the same fear is in Korea, but it's even worse because they've been under a dictatorship even longer than East Germany. So the Arab world basically has been under a self-imposed tyranny and dictatorship for centuries. Now we want them to change. And as Austin points out in his writing on Turkey, the Turks, you know, basically reverted back to Islamic, you know, rule, and that is causing big problems in Turkey, even though since the 1920s, they have supposed to have gone secular. So what the 73 war was a watershed in many, as Austin is pointing out, in many ways that people don't realize. It really was a major watershed in Middle Eastern history, and I think people are only now beginning to appreciate it.
Now, you're talking about the Ataturk's revolution on that.
Yes, in Turkey, but I'm just an example of the problems that the Arabs are going to be encountering. They haven't even found their Ataturk yet. Once they do, then comes the hard part, because it's going to take decades to really, you know, totally switch over. Because right now, the Turks are going backwards, or trying to anyway.
Let me pick up a couple of things that Jim said and take it from a different angle, because, you know, as Jim said, the big fact out of the 73 war is that a number of Arab leaders very begrudgingly accepted the fact that they couldn't defeat Israel militarily. This is comes back to the line of analysis about Sadat that I touched on earlier that I kind of pulled back from, but is that Sadat had already come to the conclusion that Israel was not going to be defeated militarily or overrun, and how could he create a political situation, political ambiance in Egypt where he could make a move to peace, reconciliation, whatever, permanent ceasefire with the Israelis. If that was in his mind, and before he was assassinated, he indicated that it was something that he had thought about as a strategic possibility, and certainly he executed it. He did carry it through. This reflects what Jim says, but it also shows what Jim says about making the judgment that we're not going to knock them out without, unless we have a nuclear weapon, okay? But we're not going to knock them out. How do we deal with them? But it also demonstrates, again, Jim's point about how hard it is to change, because here you had a popular Arab leader, Sadat, he was popular in Egypt, assassinated by the Muslim Brotherhood radicals for doing what, to get back to the economic angle, Jim said, you know, Israel's economy is an embarrassment, or the Arabs are jealous or whatever. Look, there are a number of Egyptian business people and Jordanian business people that still look to Israel as a source of capital, trade, financing. They've made the transition to saying, hey, we want to cooperate, and that's we're still talking. What was the Camp David process of 78, 79? Here we are 34 years later, and it's still a cold peace. But as Jim has pointed out, Egypt and Israel have not gone back to war, and the wars that Israel has fought have been with proxy actors, Hezbollah, Hamas, and the like on its periphery. So that is another, and Jim's right, that's another point about the October War of 73.
All right. Well, it looks like we'll continue to watch things. I think the thing that I get from what both of you say is that in order for things to improve in the Middle East, that there are going to be some major attitude changes needed on the Arabs' part, where normally you hear from the leftist press and the leftist commentators and like that, that it's Israel that needs the change. Would that sum it up pretty well?
Yes. In a nutshell, exactly.
I think Jim's talking the core of what Jim's going after is a cultural change.
Right.
A cultural adaptation would probably be a better way to put it, and then that reflects back to what Kemal Ataturk managed to engineer in Turkey after 1923. So,
right. Yeah, and I guess that would be the thing to look at as the model for how it could happen.
Well, Dan, you can sell my book right now. It's still up there on the
right.
page, right?
That's right. Ataturk by Austin Bay. It's a good book. All right, we'll wrap it up there, and we'll talk to you gentlemen next time.
Take care, guys.
Bye.
Sure.